Well, it's very good to be with you. 50 years, it doesn't seem 50 years, I'm sure. For there must be some people here, I think, who still remember the setting up of Corrymeela. Where we sit now, not exactly where we sit now, but the property on which it's built was purchased by Ray Davey and his Queen's students 50 years ago. And it cost them £7,000. So I went away and had a look how much was £7,000 in those days. And it was actually 10 times, as far as I could see, 10 times the annual average salary, which tells you something. And they raised it in 10 days. That's some testament to the purpose and the courage with which they started. And I was listening to Sunday Sequence this morning. I don't know if any of you were singing mightily, but Sunday Sequence was from Corrymeela 2, and it was very good. And I heard this definition of what Corrymeela is, and I liked the lumpy crossroads bit. It seemed to me it most correctly described what Corrymeela has been about, because it's kind of suggestive of potholes and the kind of bends you get as you drive up to Corrymeela, and the diminished visibility and the lack of comprehension that there could possibly be anything at the end of this road, you know? And that's the road to peace, isn't it? That's the road to peace. So there is humour in Corrymeela, you know? And I think you've had... I know there's been, you know, very difficult situations dealt with here, but I think there have been many moments of fun and laughter over the years, and I've certainly known them. I've also known very challenging moments. But I came to Northern Ireland in 77 when things were pretty bad, and I very quickly became aware of Corrymeela. And firstly, it was just in terms of what it stood for in terms of respite from the violence of the city and that sort of thing. But then I began to realise that it had a much broader purpose, and now I see the breadth of the purpose with which Corrymeela is engaged, from faith issues to international issues and everything else. And I often wondered, though, we brought the kids up here when they were small, and it's a fairly rugged sort of coastline, this North Antrim coastline, and my experience was that it rained more often than it didn't rain, and it must have seemed quite wild and inhospitable, and yet it did become and has become a place of refuge and reconciliation and relaxation for tens of thousands of people. And the work which has been done here is both personal and communal, and it's taken so many forms, and a huge contribution has been made here to the evolution of peace in our troubled country. And, you know, the reality of peacemaking is that you do not see peacemaking. You hear the product of peacemaking. You see the consequences of peacemaking, but you don't actually know it's going on for the most part. And 50 years on, there are almost 40 staff, full-time staff here, 20 long-term volunteers, hundreds of other volunteers. And I know that many of you probably have worked on this site very generously for decades. Sorry. That road is still in my head, sorry. It's that road. And I'd like to pay tribute to all those who've worked here, and I'd like to remember all the work that's been done here. And I'd like most particularly to remember the faith and the determination of Ray Davey and his gentle and very courageous and very feisty wife, Kathleen. I remember last time I was here, when she was here, she gave me a book of her poetry. I have it still. And since this place is founded on Christianity, I give thanks to the Lord for the generosity and the compassion and the humour and the energy and the love that has made all this possible. I want to think a moment about where we were, because I think it can seem unreal now when we look at the documentaries of the old film footage of the Troubles. I spoke recently in Ballycastle about a book I launched last year, and it's a book by a girl called Emma O'Callaghan, and it's called Belfast Days, A 1972 Teenage Diary. And those teenage girls among you, you should read this book. You'd find it very interesting. It's very challenging, and it's very challenging to read about this girl growing up in such difficult circumstances, but with the normal preoccupations of what she looked like and getting clothes for events and all sorts of things like that, you know. And many of us here remember those awful nights when Belfast was subjected to multiple bomb threats and attacks, and indeed other places. And we didn't have the sat-nav that can bring us and can misguide us, but we didn't have sat-nav. We often didn't have street maps in our cars, and we would head off home from work, certainly in the university, to try and get home, and then find out that the roads were closed because of bomb scares and things. And so you were trying to negotiate your way around a city. And the thing that I remember most is that you always seem to end up in the wrong territory. And you knew it was the wrong territory by the markers. You know what I mean? And it didn't matter whether you were Catholic or Protestant, you always ended up in the wrong territory. So it was very difficult. It was almost part of our culture that we were constantly lost in the wrong territory. And that says something about the fact that it was the wrong territory, that we couldn't go in there, that we didn't feel safe there. And I think we still have a bit of that around our country today. It didn't matter. You just knew that you were where you shouldn't be. And I remember too, I'm sure Duncan maybe is a bit younger than me, but he maybe remembers this, the students who used to come in the morning and would tell about being picked up by the army in the Land Rovers and maybe given a bit of a beating and taken to the other side of the city to the other territory and then just dumped to make a lonely and dangerous way home. They were difficult days. And I remember too the bombs exploding across Belfast Lough as I lectured in Jordanstown, and sometimes indeed on the university campus. And in some ways, it doesn't seem possible that all that actually did happen, with all the terror and the tragedy and the trauma and the destruction and the division, but it did. And I just want to remember that during the bad years, 116 people died in the Republic of Ireland, but there were over 3,600 terrorist-related murders here, and 50,000 injuries as a consequence of the security situation. And I think the figure of 50,000 injuries is grossly undercalculated because people didn't report all the injury they suffered. And the Victims Commission recently estimated that the conflict resulted in 500,000 victims, defining them as those who are directly affected by bereavement, by physical injury or by trauma as a result of the conflict. But now children play in the summer, and rioting isn't the inevitable consequence. We don't see soldiers on the street, and we have a feeling that we have peace. But we do still have paramilitary violence, and we still have too much sectarianism. In the year ending 31st of March this year, there were 3 deaths due to the security situation. There were 94 shootings and assaults by paramilitaries, 48 by loyalists, 46 by Republicans. There were 73 shooting incidents and 26 bombing incidents, and I could go on. We're not quite there yet. Much has been achieved. We've done a huge amount. There's a pattern, you know, for how you make peace when you've got these conflict situations, and we've done most of it. We've had ceasefires. We've had disarmament, the laying down of the guns. We've had decommissioning, the destruction of the guns. We've had prisoner release. We've had the establishment of our own parliament, the assembly. We've had the devolution of power to that assembly. But the past keeps coming back, and you know that's normal too. It's normal that after such a conflict there'll be a debate. It may be an acknowledged debate, it may be an unacknowledged debate about the legacy of the past and about its capacity to undo the present and about the cost of addressing past injustice and the cost of failing to do so. And Northern Ireland isn't different from anywhere else I've worked in the world in this context. Different solutions have been found across the world. We now have found our own solutions, and they're not difficult solutions. They're in the Stormont House Agreement. And I think if we did what was in the Stormont House Agreement, we would go a long way to providing the structure which will consolidate our peace. But we're not there, because there was supposed to be a commission on the things that really separate us, flags, identity, culture and tradition. It was supposed to be established by June 2015. It hasn't even started. We were supposed to get devolved power on parades. There's to be an oral history archive, a research project led by academics to produce an accurate factual timeline and statistical analysis. Victims and survivors are to have access to high-quality services. There's to be a comprehensive mental health trauma service. And the work is to be undertaken to find a way to provide pensions for those who are severely physically injured as a consequence of the Troubles. And we're to have a historic investigations unit to investigate the crimes of the past. And there's to be a commission on information retrieval to take care of the still missing people. And we're going to have an implementation reconciliation group to oversee themes, etc. So we've got all these structures. We're to have a civic advisory panel. And they're fine words, and they really would go a long way. But the problem is our governments are not capable of delivering on what they've agreed. You know, these are vital elements for our peace. We need to consolidate the peace before another generation get tied up in the undercurrent of paramilitarism that still we still have. The funding that we need to consolidate the peace is not there. How could the two issues of welfare reform, which is holding everything up, and dealing with the past be inextricably linked in one document? Where is the morality of that? What were the governments thinking about? I know what the British government were thinking about. I'm not sure what our government were thinking about. And you know, everybody says, well, the Assembly might collapse. That seems to be, have been a constant theme since the Assembly was established. But there isn't ever a good time to do things in Northern Ireland. We always have to get on. I realised that when I was setting up the office and when I was training my staff and things like that, because that time that Duncan talked about when we brought the staff out here and we were training, it was training, but it was really soul-searching almost to find out who we were, where we'd come from, so that we didn't bring bias or prejudice or anything like that into the work that we are doing. And I remember we had all sorts of discussions about how we present ourselves and what we do and whether staff would wear suits and shirts and ties or jeans and T-shirts. And, you know, if you wore a suit and shirt and tie, somebody might think you were a policeman. And that might be, it might make people react in a certain way to you. And if you weren't properly dressed, people wouldn't think you were professional. So we had all those debates, but then we came to a very sticky moment. And I'll never, ever forget it, because we were sitting in a bigger room than this here. And somebody said, OK, what about poppies? And it was October. And I thought to myself, oh, dear. So I sat and looked, and because the thesis was we had to do this together. I couldn't direct it. I had to have them hearts, souls and minds behind a proper impartial service. So we had to deal with the issue. So could they wear poppies? So it got quite hot and heavy, you know, because one group were quite used to wearing poppies. And you have to understand, I came from England where the poppy was just part of life. It was how you provided limbs for limbless servicemen, etc., etc. Here it had different connotations. And I do remember the discussion getting hot and heavy, and I remember thinking I needed to intervene, but then I shouldn't intervene. And I remember somebody saying to me, no, just wait. And I waited, and eventually they solved it. And we never had a problem about poppies. Flags I dealt with. When the Northern Ireland office asked me where I wanted my flagpole, I told I didn't. That was easy enough. So, what are the ongoing problems that we now face? Well, the first is providing a service for our victims. We have 91 victims' organisations. We have a victim and survivors service. We have a public-funded victim and survivors forum. And we have, at last, a new victims commissioner whom I welcome and to whom I wish well. But actually, we're not providing at all well for our victims. And remember, the victims commission said there are 500,000 victims. We currently have survivors of troubles-related attacks who must choose between pain relief and physio. And physio keeps them mobile, and pain relief makes them possible for them to move. We have troubles-related amputees who wait months and months and months for prosthetic limbs, with all the problems that that creates. Because if you don't use your remains of your amputated limb, if you can't keep moving, the muscles atrophy, and then you've got more problems. And then maybe the artificial limb doesn't work. All that is wrong. We don't have pensions for people who would have earned good pensions, but because of the injury that they suffered, they're stuck in a wheelchair and have been for the whole of their life. We've got some great good pressure, good practice here, but it's under massive pressure. And I think perhaps about, say, Wave, which offers counselling services, demand for its counselling rose 52% last year. And the people coming for counselling with troubles-related problems are aged from 6 to 80. And how does a 6-year-old suffer from troubles which really stopped 15 years ago? I'm sure you can work it out for yourselves. It's the child who lives in a house with someone who has suffered a catastrophic injury, who sees and feels the tension and the pain and the distress and the post-traumatic stress, which results in people behaving in ways that they might not otherwise behave. So there's a problem there. And there's a problem, too, that many years after a traumatic event, when people think they've put it all away and dealt with it, it can come back and attack them again. And I think of a colleague of mine once who was blown up in a bomb explosion and who came back to work and who got on with his work and everything was fine. And 25 years later, he just had a complete breakdown. And he was into flashbacks and all those things. And that is making a demand on the services which people didn't anticipate. We should have anticipated it, but they didn't. We need to understand the nature of trauma. We need to understand how things happen. And we don't invest as a society sufficiently in the care of our victims. The budget for the Victim and Survivor Service from 2013 to 2015, that's 2 years, is £12,377,512. Now, the money is fragmented across all those organisations, and I think we have to ask questions about what that money is being used for. Is it right to use money to take people for holidays when we have people who can't get pain relief and physio? How are we going to sort this out? But the real problem and the real awful thing is that in 2013 alone, that's 1 year, we spent double that sum policing parades and protests. Still, that's what we're doing. And we spent £12 million between July 2013 and October 2014 on the Twaddell Avenue protests. And each month that's costing £330,000 a year. And we're allowing it to happen as a people. We're not saying, no, we can't take this anymore. We're not saying this has to stop. There seems to be a fear that if we say this has to stop, we're trying to interfere with somebody's freedom of expression, of opinion, whatever it is. But the reality is we need to make sensible decisions about how we spend money. Because Twaddell Avenue, actually what it's doing is that it's creating more division and more tension up there in North Belfast. We need leadership on a massive scale in both communities if we're to resolve that and to allow the money to be used properly. And another thing that has happened, which has caused me some concern over the past couple of years, is the rising tension in the criminal justice sector. We've seen it between the Police Service of Northern Ireland and the Police Ombudsman, when the Chief Constable wouldn't let the Police Ombudsman into police premises and wouldn't give them documentation. We've seen it, and the Police Ombudsman had to go to court to get that resolved. We've seen it between the coroners and the police service, where the coroners are trying to conduct inquests into historic deaths, and the police haven't got the resources to produce the documents. And so the inquest can't happen. We've seen massive problems with the HET, the Historic Inquiries Team, now abolished. And we have a Chief Constable who says he doesn't have the resources to deal with the past if he is to police the present. And we have a coronial system, which has two coroners, one of whom is retiring in October. So we have major problems in our criminal justice system. Now, the Minister of Justice is working to try and resolve this, but the thing upon which we must pin our new society is the establishment and the support for the rule of law. And if we haven't got a policing system that's working properly, if we haven't got a coronial system, if the things aren't working, we can't say that we have the rule of law. So those are the problems, okay? I want to say a word about building trust, though, because that's what's gone on in these buildings over the past 50 years. Much has been done, much has been achieved. Don't think that I'm not saying that we haven't come a very long way. I am. But the work of peacemaking is incremental and it's difficult. And we need to think about the foundations for a solid and sustainable peace, because they're not those institutions that I've just described to you. They will not build our peace. Trust is key to all the relationships we have. And you know, because you're here, you know that trust is the product of both knowledge and understanding. If people know and understand the other, they see the other no longer as the other, but a person who shares their world. And if you share my world, you can't be a threat. And I think part of our problem is we still don't, as Catholics and Protestants, understand that we're not a threat to each other, and we shouldn't be a threat to each other. There are some situations in which it's very clear that if you're one or the other, there's a problem. And we have to get rid of those. And I want to talk about truth and reconciliation, because they're the foundations upon which trust grows and from which trust will emerge to enable a democratic society in which the rule of law does exist and which there's peace. And real trust is the product of knowledge and understanding and relationship, and as I said, that's what you've done here. If people know what happened and if they know why, if they experience a relationship based on respect and dignity and love, then they can understand, no matter how difficult it may be to understand what happened to them. And when they understand, they can then make a decision to trust again. And it is a decision to trust. And those who have been most seriously hurt will need time and space and reparation, possibly. whether by apology or by even acknowledgement of what's happened or by the provision of resources. We need so many different answers. And the suffering and the difficulties of our years are well known, but there is a degree to which we're being told to get on with it. The world has seen, has observed our troubles and thinks they're solved and thinks we're getting on with it. But actually, I think we will not get on with it until we acknowledge the unhealed pain and grief, and we find ways, whatever those ways are, to bring resolution and healing. One of the problems is it seems to me that at government levels there's a fear that such trust as we have grown, such reconciliation as we've achieved, might be undermined if we move forward in the process of establishing truth. So there's tension between the fear of the consequences of revealing truth and the needs of the families of those who died and of society as a whole. Conflict is always messy, and there are fears, expectations that what might emerge might damage. And you know, if you look at South Africa, which is one of the comparators that we're given, in South Africa, they did have a truth commission, yes, but there was damage as a result of it. In South Africa, 7,116 people applied for amnesty in return for telling their story, but only 1,176 got amnesty. And even in those cases, there were many cases where people said that people did not tell the whole story. So we can't just adapt from elsewhere. We have to find our own way. And there are difficult conversations to be had, difficult acknowledgements to be made about wrongdoing by state and non-state actors. There are reparations to be made for injuries suffered. And ultimately, I think we need acceptance of realities about which people are still afraid to speak. And that's difficult. You know, I work quite a bit with the families of the disappeared, and one of the things I've learned from them is that so many of them were told by the IRA not to ask questions, not to talk about it, not to make a fuss in public, or else. And those people who lived for decades, not knowing what had happened to their loved ones, lived also with that fear and that trauma. We have to find a way to care for all these people. And the question always bounces back when I say these things: we cannot afford the truth. We cannot afford that type of reconciliation. But if we don't, I don't think we'll get peace. My question is, can we afford not to do what we must do? And I think it can be very hard for people to admit the truth, for perpetrators to admit the truth, to acknowledge the truth. It's hard for families to learn the truth. And sometimes the truth can be very difficult to accept, so it's not easy. But I'm very fond of Maya Angelou's quotation. She said, "History, despite its wrenching pain, cannot be unlived, but if faced with courage, it need not be lived again." So we need to face our truth with courage if we're to build a sustainable peace. I want to say a word about reconciliation and healing. I think reconciliation is a process which looks outward and forward, and which brings together elements which belong together but which have been torn apart. In a Christian sense, we talk about reconciliation as a process of acknowledgement of wrongdoing, of repentance, and of commitment to make reparation, and a desire never to be separated again, and of forgiveness. And that is a process which can and should apply in society. It needs trust. It's about not letting the past dictate the future, which is what has happened to us. It's about bringing together the goodness of all the disparate parts of our divided community and working on those foundations rather than allowing the evil of the past to separate us in the future. And I do think that is what Corrymeela does and has done, but it needs to carry on. And then I want to talk about healing, because I think healing and reconciliation are different. I think healing is a process which is personal and inward-looking. I think reconciliation is outward-looking and healing is inward-looking. I think it's of the soul and the mind and the body. And I think it's the balm for the soul. It's the mending of the broken. It's the fusing of the shattered. And it's the making whole of that which was torn apart. I don't believe that societies heal. I believe that they may be reconciled. But I think it's the wounds and the pains of individuals which may be healed. And sometimes I think it's through truth that people are brought to healing. That's fundamental to what we believe as Christians. Jesus said, "If you continue in my word, then you are truly disciples of mine, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free." So all those things have to come together to create a functional society. If we don't allow truth, if we resist reconciliation, if we do not acknowledge the trauma and the anguish, the unfinished business will continue to echo through our days until eventually, I think, we'll be forced to deal with them. And the suspicions and the distrust which run through our society, reaching to the very highest levels, will continue to undermine our fragile peace. So what then are the foundations upon which we build? The structures we are agreed on, I think. We know we need commissions and inquiries and that sort of thing. But what are the foundations upon which, the values upon which will we build? The first one is courage. Courage is necessary. I think of one situation in Harryville. There may have been some of you who came to Harryville during the time. In Harryville, there are many of you who are too young to know what happened, but we had a period of 79 weeks when Loyalists would not allow the Catholics to go to the church in Harryville because they weren't allowed to march up the road in Dunloy. And they would turn up, sometimes 300-400 of them, with firecrackers and flags and masks and sticks, and it was very noisy and very ugly, and there'd be hundreds of policemen, and we'd be trying to go to church and come from church. And it was a profoundly ugly situation, and there were people hurt and cars burned out, and the priest's house was burned, and all sorts of things happened. And it was very, very, very frightening. And I'm very bloody-minded, and I was determined I was going to go to church. And I did. And I remember at one point saying to the chief superintendent who was commanding the operation, looking across the road at all the people I wasn't allowed to talk to, was not allowed to cross the road. And I said to him, I'm going to go and talk to them. We need to talk. If we do not talk, this will go on forever. And he said to me, I'll arrest you if you try and cross the road. You'll create a breach of the peace. So I said, OK. So I toddled down the lines a bit, and I began to move across the road, you know. And a hand reached on my shoulder and said, Nuala, I will arrest you. So I didn't go across the road because I'm a coward. And anyway, I remember one night seeing a mother. And opposite the church, there was a little grassy bank about 3 feet high, and the kids used to, teenagers used to stand on it. So there were these four or five big fellas standing on there. And they were yelling obscenities at us. And then this little lady, who was even smaller than me, came along. And her son was about 6 feet something, a bit like Duncan there. So this little woman comes along, and she's obviously telling him, you're coming home, you're not engaging in this, you know. And he was having nothing of it. He wasn't going to let his street cred be damaged. And she carried on, and she carried on. I watched her. And then eventually she took her two arms, and she started pulling at the arm. And the arm was very resistant, and she pulled, and she pulled, and she won. And I thought that was courage, because she did that in the face of all the people who lived in the area who knew what she was doing. She was stepping outside the party line, if you like. She was brave. And the other thing I watched on one occasion, I watched a man who bombed the Old Bailey, a man called Jerry Kelly. He made a complaint to me. What had happened to him was that the police... He was here on Friday, right. Well, the police had broken his arm, right? A baton had come down on his arm, so he came to me to complain that the police had broken his arm. And that was fine. So as police ombudsman, I was investigating whether there had been police misconduct. Am I talking too long, Duncan?
No.
So I sent for the CCTV of the Ardoyne at the time, you know, and there were hundreds of protesters, and Republican protesters, and an Army Land Rover which had got isolated from the rest of the pack, as it were. And it was surrounded by all these young, very angry Republicans. And standing on the steps of the Land Rover, you know, there were two steps up into those Land Rovers, and standing on the steps like this is Jerry Kelly. And he's saying, no, we don't do this. No, we're not doing this. No, we've got peace. And he went on and on. And it went on for 10 minutes, maybe slightly longer than 10 minutes, while the police and the army regathered themselves and made their way down to where this Land Rover was isolated. Now, I think he could very easily have seen dead soldiers that day if it hadn't been for his courage. And so he's standing there like this, and police and the army are coming down, and a baton came down on his arm, and that's how his arm got broken. So I found that actually the police had not acted wrongly in breaking his arm, because it was unintentional, because they didn't mean to do it, and because they were trying to get their way through to rescue. It was a proportionate act in the particular circumstances, which he accepted. He was quite happy with that. What struck me that day was how far this man had travelled. that he was prepared to put his life and his reputation at stake to protect the British soldiers. That was 2005. That takes courage. And we have seen great courage on both sides. But our politicians need courage now. I think most of all our politicians need courage. They need courage to work across the divisions so that our people aren't trapped in local government regimes which are more and more sectarian. The reorganisation of local government has left us with much, much more sectarian councils. I'm sure you've noticed it. And our politicians need the strength not to stand side by side with their own, but to stand for the common good. And I'm not seeing it at the moment. We need the courage to name wrongdoing, not to deny it, just to build upon it. And we need, so courage is number one. The second thing we need is compassion and love. And compassion is walking with people in their suffering. It's not being sorry for them. That's, I think, a very important point. We really need to listen to those in difficult areas, those with difficulties, so that we can enable the solutions that they need rather than we think they need. And we need flexibility in all our key agencies, and we need them to be working together so that there really is compassion and love in this society. And I think we've come to a place now, don't tell me I haven't got the last page of this, I haven't. We've come to a place in which we can often carefully and respectfully meet and talk about things, and we can enable the understanding which will allow us to embed peace in our society. We can work together to improve our environment. We can try and create the situation in which instead of building more peace walls, we can start dismantling them. So we need courage, we need compassion and love. And the two other things I think we need, one is trust and the other is integrity. Trust I've talked about. I think we need integrity because we need to know that people are doing what is right because it is right. And we need accountability to ensure that where corruption or partiality creeps into our society, it is dealt with immediately. And I think if we build upon those four pillars, if we build upon courage, compassion and love, integrity and trust, then we will build a society which will last, and we will have a peaceful society. And our young people won't be lured into the terror and the horror that so many generations found their way into in the past. And you know, one of the things I learned, and I learned it the hard way, but one of the things I learned is we cannot judge the actions of others. We may find their actions wrong, but we cannot judge the people because we did not walk in their footsteps. Maybe I'll tell you why, because when I was in Jordanstown, I lost my first child. I was pregnant, and I was caught in a bomb, and I lost my first child. And it took me a very long time not to be angry, not to hate, not to despair, not to shout at God. I did a lot of shouting at God. Didn't understand why he couldn't save the child. But I learned eventually, trying to forgive when I couldn't forgive, that I hadn't walked in their shoes. I hadn't been in the house, perhaps, where soldiers or police had come and ripped everything apart looking for something. I hadn't been the child whose father was taken and interned. I hadn't been the child whose loved one was shot by the paramilitaries or by the security forces. So I did not know what it was that had led them to put a bomb in a lecture theatre containing 250 students. And blow it up. And once you get to that point, then you leave that to God, and the rest you work on as hard as you can. So I congratulate Coromila on 50 years of wonderful, outstanding, very, very fundamentally important work for peace here. I hope they'll continue to work for peace because it's very necessary. I know that we have things to share with the world outside, but we need to learn from our own mistakes too, and that will be part of our future. So thank you very much for listening to me.